Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Two subjects today that bring back bad memories, flooding in our area and burned out black churches in the South. We'll talk about flooding and flooding potential here as rain remains in the forecast. We'll talk about that in a couple of moments. But first, part of the fallout from last month's church shooting in Charleston and the resulting debate over the Confederate flag have been followed by a number of arson and suspected arson fires at black churches in numerous southern states, reminding many of the worst of the 1960s civil rights struggle. It has not taken long for efforts to help rebuild those churches here to emerge. Communities of faith here and elsewhere have stepped forward with fundraising campaigns. The Rebuild the Churches Fund is the local effort involving numerous faith communities and is being coordinated, that is, by Reverend Mike Kinman, the Dean of Christ Church Cathedral. He joins me in studio, as does Pastor Karen Anderson of the Ward Chapel AME Church. Thank you so much, folks, for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much.
Mike,
let me just start with you and get a status report of where the fund stands right now and who's involved.
Well, I checked it right before I came on the air, and we have an online giving portal. And we started out with a very modest goal of $25,000, and we had to bump that up a couple different times. Right now, we have had 2,245 people donate online, a total of $137,658. So we've increased the goal to $250,000. In addition, we have more than 170 congregations, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish, committing to do special collections for this fund. And none of that money has been counted yet. They're going to be doing those throughout the month of July. I know there's some churches that are even having special concerts. So we're hopeful to surpass the $250,000 goal.
You may be closer to that than you think right now.
We think we already will. We've heard already from some congregations that have raised more than $1,000 just last Sunday.
Karen, how's it going with your congregation?
Well, we are just starting. I was out of town for a week, but we're going to start this week in raising some funds, but also just getting the word out to family and friends. We've tried to be very active since August 9th, and then considering the fact that my church is AME, there are many things that are going to be done also on what we can call the connectional or the national level as well to help out the burned out churches.
Mike, what kinds of donations are you getting? I mean, are they $10, $25? Are you getting some big ones?
There's a lot of the $10 and $25 ones, which I think are wonderful. We're also getting people who are giving $500 or $1,000. So the donations are coming in all sizes. What this really represents is a feeling across the country that we don't just want to sit and watch this happen. How this fund started was these fires were not reported in the mainstream media to begin with. I learned about them on Twitter and on social media and woke up on Monday morning, the 29th of June, very frustrated that there wasn't anything to do. When I see something like this, I want to help direct people to action. So I spent about an hour searching online, figuring someone must be raising money for this somewhere, and found nothing, and realized this was an opportunity for us at Christ Church Cathedral to do what cathedrals do, which is gather the people around something for the common good. So talked with our leadership, and we very quickly set this up. And the response to it has been incredible. Again, we originally thought $25,000 was a reasonable goal. And then what happened was the next night, there was the fire at the church in Greeleyville, South Carolina. And that was the first one that got picked up by the mainstream media. And people began to be outraged by what was happening and wanted to do something, and this fund was there, and people started to give, and it is really mushroomed from there.
Karen, what does the fact that it has mushroomed as it has tell you?
I think it tells me that there's a lot more good in the world than we think. It's not reported that people have a lot of passion about issues of justice, but I don't think it makes its way to the mainstream media very much. And so people, no matter what their ability, want to participate. And I think that's why, as Mike said, the $5, $10, $25 contributions probably mean more than the larger $1,000 and $1,500 contributions. These are people who are giving just what they have, but they say, I want to be a part of rebuilding because they are outraged, because they do see an injustice. And the reality is that when the people begin to speak up, then things begin to change. And so I think it's important, and it speaks to the power of social media. Mike put it on Facebook, and suddenly people from across the nation saw a post and began to respond, and not just with donations, but with prayers and with sentiments of, we stand in solidarity with you. We're part of this with you. We don't want to see this happen again. And I think that's the significance.
The last numbers I saw indicated there had been 8 churches that suffered fires. 7 of them are either arson or suspected arson. 1 is a possible lightning strike. Is that pretty much square with what you know?
It's interesting. There are different reports. Uh-huh. What we decided right at the beginning was there were 4 that we knew that we wanted to support. Glover Grove Baptist Church in Warrensville, South Carolina, College Hill Seventh-day Adventist Church in Knoxville, Briar Creek Baptist Church in Charlotte, and God's Power Church of Christ in Macon. 3 of those 4 were confirmed arson. Mm-hmm. The 4th, they had ruled out all accidental causes, which meant it was intentionally set. We knew we wanted to raise money for those. There have been others out of that, and I hear anywhere from 6 to 9, and it really depends on who you talk to. And so part of what we need to do now is, we know we're going to give money to those 4 churches, is we need to decide, do we expand that circle? And that's why I realized really quickly this wasn't a decision I wanted to make on my own. Mm-hmm. And so we have wonderful people here in St. Louis. We called up Karen, Susan Talvey, who is the rabbi at Central Reform Congregation, and Ashley Yates, who's a Ferguson activist. And that's the group that will be making the decision about where the money goes.
Karen, tax against black churches is nothing new. I think it will surprise a lot of people with what's going on, that this has been going on for a couple of centuries at least. Why are churches targeted the way they are and have been?
I think it's because of the role of the black church in the community. The black church in our community has always been a source of both what we call priestly and prophetic teaching. So priestly deals with your spirituality, but the prophetic is speaking to the conditions of society. And in the black church, we have a social justice consciousness. And so from the very beginning, if you think of the roots of the black church, going back to the times of slavery, when slaves were not allowed to worship, they stole away to places they called brush harbors and hush harbors. Mm-hmm. Those were forms of rebellion against oppression. We're going to worship. We're going to be able to serve the God that we serve. And that has been the tradition throughout history. When you think of the black church, when you think of things that, such as the civil rights movement, it has a very strong foundation in the black church. When it comes to mobilizing the black community, it happens from the black church. It happens from the power of the voice of a black preacher. That's what W.E.B. Mm-hmm. Du Bois said. He said, the black preacher is the most unique personality that has been created on American soil among Africans. It's the power of the prophetic voice to speak to the conditions, to speak to the oppression, to speak to systematic injustices. And so if you attack the church, then you, in essence, what you're saying is you're trying to silence the voice of the people.
Mike, did you want to add to that?
No, everything that you said so incredibly well, I would echo. People are ingenious, and when you strip people of power or deny them power, we as human beings are going to find ways to get together and form centers of power. And that's what the black church is, and it's the power of the gospel, and it's the power of the people. And so it's something that those of us who were raised in predominantly white churches, we have access to all other sorts of power, and so we might not realize the incredible centers of power that black churches are. And so for any of us, if our faith home burned down, it would be traumatic. In the black community, it is so much more, because it represents power that may be the only power a community feels it has. It's also centers of service for communities that are incredibly underserved by just about every other service provider. Mm-hmm. The church in the Briar Creek Baptist Church in Charlotte, the main sanctuary didn't burn down. It was their program building. That program building houses a day camp mm-hmm. for more than 100 kids. The parents need that day camp so the parents can go to work. And so the, it's not just, oh, we don't have a place to go to church on Sunday. There are huge ripple effects in the community when one of these churches is no longer there.
So in a sense, the people who are lighting these fires, the arsonists, kind of know what they're doing.
I absolutely believe they know what they're doing.
Karen, how about locally? What kind of situation do we have here? Have there been incidents? Has there been harassment? Has there been anything we can point to that would bring African-American churches here into the picture?
Not to the level of what we've seen in the Charleston area.
But there have been defacings and things of that kind.
Yeah, and I think that's not new. Yeah. So the reality is I think that we've always come together as a faith community. Even if we go all the way back to August 9th, you saw gatherings in churches. You saw congregations coming together to worship together, to be a voice and a presence. To let the people know that the church is here, and not only to be a voice, but also to be a sanctuary, to be a place where people can come when they have concerns and issues. And I think that's the other power of the church, is it's always been a sanctuary where people can come to have needs met. I mean, the reality is, for many years, the only place that blacks could be educated was through the church. That's where schools were created, educational vehicles, social programs to meet the needs of people who were hungry and did not have the resources. And so that continues even today. And the beauty of what is going on right now is being able to see it expand past just black churches. The beauty is to see a Christ Church Cathedral say that we need to do something and that we stand in solidarity with the black community, because the reality is in our nation, we still say that the 11 o'clock hour on Sunday mm-hmm. is the most segregated time sure. mm-hmm. in our nation, mm-hmm. That regardless of our relationships outside of church, we don't come together to fellowship. We don't come together to worship. We don't come together to work on issues. And so this is drawing us together to begin to address issues, not putting it simply in the context of this affects the black community, but the reality is if it affects the African-American community, it impacts the entire community.
Yeah. I should point out, too, there's a very active Muslim effort
yes.
in this regard nationwide, I
yes.
think, in 14 different
states. They've actually been in touch with us yes. Because Central Reform Congregation here has been wonderful. They took on the task of contacting the individual churches that had been burned, and there was a lot of legwork in that. Mm-hmm. And so the Muslim group that is raising money has been in touch with us, and we're sharing those connections. So what's happening is a lot of different efforts, and we're all working together. And again, that is a huge hope for me. Mm-hmm. That shows that the power of love among all people is so much greater than the power of hate.
I've got to take a break. We'll do that now. We'll come back. If listeners would like to get into this conversation, we'd love to have you. What about your support for the project we're talking about, which is a fundraising effort to help rebuild those black churches in the South that have been destroyed by fire, many of them suspected arson, others confirmed arson. And we're raising a lot of money in our community here. We're looking for $250,000 before all is said and done, and more than that if it can possibly happen. My guests in studio are Reverend Karen Anderson, pastor at the Ward Chapel AME Church here, and Reverend Mike Kinman, dean at Christ Church Cathedral. Give us a call if you'd like to be a part of this discussion at 382-8255. It's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. Back in a moment, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Reverend Karen Anderson and Reverend Mike Kinman. Mike, as we were taking that break there, I feel like we're on a quiz show here. You've got a new tally for us.
Our cathedral administrator, Annette Carr, just emailed me and said that there's about $10,000 of checks that we've received in the mail this week. That's the tally so far from this week. And those are coming from around the country, and so are the online donations. Mm-hmm. So we're close to $150,000 right now.
Right. By the way, we'll put a link to your website on our website at stlpublicradio.org so people will have that kind of access as well.
Great, thanks.
How specifically is the money going to be used?
We're actually going to be having a conversation about this tomorrow. What we have said initially is that all the funds, first of all, really clear, Christ Church Cathedral is not seeing one penny of this. Any of our staffing or volunteer, we're donating all that. All the money is going to be going to these four churches, perhaps more, and it will be going to rebuilding efforts. Now, if perchance more money is raised than the congregations need, then they will go towards expanding or improving the physical plants. We're also going to talk about the possibility, some of the churches have said, can it go to replacing robes and hymnals and prayer books and things destroyed in the fire? And so this is why we assembled this council of advice to make these decisions. What we want to do in every case is to honor the intent of the donors, but really to help these congregations do what they need to do to get back on their feet. But none of it will be going to salaries or to individual people.
Karen, it's my understanding that there has been some reluctance on the part of officials to label these arsons hate crimes. What are your thoughts about that? They're calling it terrorism, which of course it is, but what are your thoughts?
My personal thoughts is it is a fear in our nation to really address the issues of systemic racism. I think that's a hard conversation to have. And I think that officials, once they begin the conversation, are afraid of how do they navigate. And so we use the word terrorism. I'm not sure that for me they're that different. Racism, terrorism, it's still a form of terrorism to strike fear, to cause confusion, to try and destroy. I don't know that they're different, but I think the official stance of not wanting to call it a hate crime opens up an entire another bag of worms that sometimes the government's not ready to step into, to be honest.
I think the distinction might be that hate crimes carry with it certain penalties that other crimes don't.
Yes.
And that's an important factor. Your thoughts on this, Mike?
I mean, hate crime is a legal term, and as you said, there are certain ramifications to that. I absolutely echo what Pastor Anderson said. I think if you haven't been the recipient of oppression, if you haven't been the recipient of hate, it's much easier to think in terms of, oh, how can you legislate against someone's motivations? When you've been on the receiving end of that, it's a whole different ballgame. When you've been on the receiving end of that, as every person of color in this country has, you realize that it is an absolutely critical distinction. Because it is an impulse that is bent on the annihilation of a community.
Another part of it is, I think, and maybe the reluctance to call it what some people are calling it, the hate crime, is the fact that there has to be some manifestation other than the crime itself, people saying something, saying we're doing it against this particular people, this particular group. So whatever, they'll get that sorted out. The main thing we want to talk about now is rebuilding those churches. We have a call. Let's bring in Paul calling from St. Louis. Paul, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yes, I saw a piece from France 24 online about two or three days ago, and they said in this 10-year period, 1995 to 2005, I believe those were the dates, there were 2,000 fires in black churches in the United States. And I thought about that, I just thought this is incredible that, you know, that's one every other day. They couldn't have just been natural occurrences. And I also was surprised that none of the American media that I had seen ever showed us any kind of a national statistic before.
Thanks for the call, Paul.
So I have a couple comments on that. First of all, it shows that these incidences are not isolated. The second, really more insidious piece of that is black churches are in poor communities in many cases, which means in many cases they have to deal with substandard wiring, inadequate fire protection because they're in impoverished, economically impoverished communities. So even if they aren't intentionally set, these are the conditions that much of black America lives in. And there's a fundamental injustice in that, too. Fire response times in black communities in this country are far worse than they are in white communities. And so what's interesting about a statistic like that is you can take that in a lot of different directions and identify lots of different ways that the black community in America is oppressed.
Karen, what are you hearing from members of your congregation? I know you haven't been in total touch with them recently, but I'm sure you've had some feedback with regard to what's going on, not only in terms of fundraising, but what's going on down south.
The initial response is that it was extremely emotional. I think for many members, and many of my members of my congregation are older, and so for them it brought back very many memories of previous church burnings. It brought back memories of issues during Jim Crow. Many of them lived through that. Many of my members come from places like Mississippi and Alabama. And so for some people, it called up memories that they had long repressed. And so the first Sunday after the shooting in Charleston was a very difficult time at church. There were a lot of overflowing emotions. There was fear, to be honest, even with security at our church. You know, it's a heightened sense of awareness that even the church is not a safe place. And then when the churches began to burn, again, another layer on top of all of those repressed memories. So we go from individual attacks to now we're attacking the church in general and the fear that this is going to become more widespread. And then there was also anger because there was not coverage in the media and that it came out on Twitter and it came out on Facebook, but you were not seeing it on MSNBC. You were not seeing it on CNN, which again goes back to another piece of oppression that Mike talked about, that issues within the black community are not deemed newsworthy.
Unless it's a shooting, or
Unless it's a shooting,
or something like that. Yeah. Your thoughts, Mike? I mean, obviously, you're buying into this entirely.
Well, it's the reality if you choose to look at it.
Yeah.
And I don't think I have anything to add to what Pastor Karen said.
And can I just add the other word that I forgot to use? There's also an outrage that in 2015 we are still living under the same. Systematic oppressions. We're still living under the same myths that are fueling the hatred towards an entire group of people. It's the frustration that in 2015 we have not moved to the point where we can see one another as human.
Mm-hmm. I wonder. Go ahead, Mike.
I'll say, and what is critically important right now for we who are white, for white people to do, is to listen deeply to these cries, to listen deeply to the experience of people who have grown up black in America about what this life is like, is to listen and believe them. Because the world didn't change on August 9th. Some of us just started paying attention for the first time.
Yeah, I wonder if all of it is going to make a difference in the sense that, Karen, you've mentioned the word having conversations early in our discussion here. There's been a lot of talk about having conversations since the Michael Brown shooting. I wonder if this time it's different, this past year is going to make a difference in race relations. There's been so many things have happened, and this is just the latest. If, in fact, this conversation is going to produce results or action, finally.
Well, as a person of faith, it is my hope and my prayer that it will begin to change things. My hope is stemmed from watching congregations come together to have sacred conversations about race, to watch as different organizations are bringing black and white congregations together. But my hope is greater than that. Some of the dialogue has to simply happen, and I think Mike would agree with me, in white congregations. Mm-hmm. Because so often what happens is people want black people to explain why they feel like they do. And it's not necessarily for us to always explain. Sometimes the conversations have to occur in white congregations to ask the question, why do you feel as you do? Mm-hmm. What are the fears that you have that are keeping you from engaging with people who don't look like you? And particularly within a faith community, when we preach that we are all created in God's image, then we have to have that conversation that says, if that's true, this is your sister, this is your brother, and it doesn't matter the color of their skin. But many of these conversations are not necessarily for blacks to sit and defend who they are, defend how they feel, or defend why they feel the way they are. These are conversations that are going to happen in some homogeneous white denominations and congregations.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I think I heard you say before we went on the air that your congregation is about 85% white. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're 85% white.
What kind of conversations are you hearing and having?
We're having incredible conversations. I want to recommend to everybody Amy Hunter at the YWCA. She's the diversity director. Yeah. There. They have a curriculum called Witnessing Whiteness. It is a 13-week program over 26 weeks of white people talking to white people about race. The Diversity Awareness Partnership has a program called Listen, Talk, Learn. We're hosting one of those first week of August. And we've also had community forums. We've been preaching about this stuff for a long time. And so what it is even within our congregation, we have the different groups in the room, but we don't always interact with each other. And we're a diverse congregation, but we can be a segregated diversity. So part of what we've talked a lot about since August 9th is how, yes, there's work out there in the streets to be done, but there's also work inside to be done, and we need to balance both of those. I wanted to add one more thing to what to Pastor Anderson answered your question about, will there be a difference this time? And I say, absolutely, this is going to be different. And it's because there's a couple different game changers going on. There's the leadership of two groups that is different. The first is the young people, and the second is women. And that's who's leading this new civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And it is young activists like Brittany Farrell and Alexis Templeton and Ashley Yates. And it is amazing women, particularly women pastors like Pastor Anderson and Tracy Blackman, and the list goes on. That's a game changer, and that is what is going to make this different. And that's two groups of people that are not going to let this conversation go away and not going to let us get comfortable again.
And that's the difference this time, I think, that the energy is really being sustained and it's spreading across the country. Mm-hmm. We'll have to leave it at that. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Reverend Karen Anderson, great to see you. Thank you so much. Good luck with you and your congregation and the church and with this fundraising drive.
Thank you.
Put the muscle on them now.
People can donate by going to ChristChurchCathedral.us. And there's a link there that you can donate to the fund.
All righty. We'll put a link to all of that on our website at stopublicradio.org. Karen and Mike, thank you so much for being
thank
with
you,
us.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're all saying rain, rain, go away, but it's where it's going that is the problem. More in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.